Satta Sambhojanga, Satta 7. And Bojanga comes from Bodhi, awake. Janga from the word Anga, meaning limb. The limbs of awakening, the seven limbs of awakening. Energetic ones and calming ones. It was so of such great value that it's even used as a protection and as a means of restoring health to the ill and as a direct path to self-realization. As long as I've been going to Burma, which is since the mid-70s, when one could only stay a week at a time, it's been ruled by dictatorship, individual and military dictatorship. And the nature, the mental nature of that dictatorship is really quite sick, as in pathological, like weird beliefs and superstitions of every nature. It included, with an earlier dictator who's now dead, fear that every foreigner in there was either CIA or KGB. And so every one of us would have to leave for periods of time, even when we were in robes. And then, so those of us who were living there would go to Thailand for however long it took to get a new visa and go back. Just the way it is. The silver lining of a country like that is that it's preserve probably the greatest collection of pure Dhamma transmitters of anywhere I know in the world. Just because it's been closed to the outside world and globalization and all the ills that come with that. So it was a really lucky period of time in those decades to meet a lot of these really great nuns and monks. And it was even so when we'd have to go to Thailand, because it wasn't so long after the Vietnam War era, and there was still an innocence largely in the Thai tradition, the forest monk tradition there that's now nearly collapsed. And one of the places, one of the three or four places I went to was right in Bangkok, next to the Wat Bavorn, where the king and queen would go to give their merit and dana and support the sangha, the nuns and monks. And do their practice. And there was often there was always some distinguished abbot or guest there. And in those early years, 81, 82, 83, one of these distinguished guests was from the south, but his name was Pra. Pra is a word for like monk or a respectful Thai term for the Buddha as well. Pra Ajahn Dun Atulo. People simply called him Luang Pu, which is a respectful term for grandfather. He was there a lot. The king really loved him, and he was often invited for ceremonies. And regarded like many of the great Sangha of the north, of the northeast, and in Burma, to be a noble one, an Arya, one with no more disturbance in the mind, no more greed, hatred, and delusion. There's really no mark of enlightenment, you know. There's no characteristic particularly like the teachers who give remarkable talks and repeat suttas and attract large followings. It does not at all necessarily mean they're deeply accomplished. The ones I felt fortunate to meet were, I learned to have a hint of their quality of heart by their humility, by their near invisibility in some ways. And this monk, Ajahn Dun Atulo, or Luangpu, as I'll call him, he was one of those. And one evening in April 1981, he came from the palace after performing a ceremony, and he was resting. And a quite high-ranking, popular monk came in, also known to be a meditator and meditation master. And he said to Luangpu, he said, they say that, they say a person who was a yaka in a former life, a yaka is like a benevolent spirit, referred to him last night, I believe, Michelle did, or yesterday, like Upandita, when he was visiting the Big Island, when it exploded volcanically, he considered Peli a kind of half and half, the sometimes yaka, which is a mostly benevolent spirit, but also has a little mischievous nature to her, you know, and that was her fire and her fight and so forth. And sometimes Deva. And Deva, more the expression of that purity and nobility. So anyway, this monk is saying, I've heard that someone who's a yaka in their past life, if when they're reborn in the present life as a human again, have these magical powers and know how to apply them almost in any way they want. And Luangpu, who had been lying down, he immediately sat up and said, he said this, I've never been interested in that sort of thing at all, but have you ever meditated to this point? And he mentions this Pali word, pasitupapada, which means the moment of the mind when it smiles of its own nature without any intention to smile. It happens, he said, Luangpu said, it happens only in a noble one's mind, heart. It doesn't happen in ordinary people because it lies beyond the conditions of fabrication, free in and of itself. The Sata Bodhanga, the seven limbs of awakening, take us beyond fabrication. And fabrication, which I'll try to weave in a little bit in the remaining factors I'm going to talk about tonight, calm, concentration, equanimity. There's a really good word, Pali word for fabrication, and that word is papancha. And the sound and the feel of the word implies the nature of fabrication, which is a very sticky mind, which is always proliferating and embellishing, fabricating experience, like almost the moment that we have experience, a thought, a sensation, a sight, a sound, already the mind is off. You know, we've just sort of been generalizing. We start associating or thinking or comparing and so forth. But what really happens is this habitual deep psychological process rooted in delusion of mental fabrication, mental proliferation called papancha. It immediately creates a story. And it's conceptual, and it's deep, and we tend to identify and believe it. We take it to be true. And it's really responsible for the block of this stream of sambojanga, the blockage of these limbs of awakening from happening. They create the restlessness and anxiety that keep the mind disturbed and distracted. So, it's helpful to understand because again and again, that's what we come up against. Every time we feel somehow stuck or blocked or unable to navigate a particular turbulent system, what we want to first look for is any sense or any felt sense of mental proliferation. Now, am I making a story of this? Am I lost in some story? Am I caught somewhere? Or can the mind again just come back and rest in things as they are? Which is often why body is the first domain, the first pasture of our exploration, because it's always here, it's always available. The body doesn't lie. It shows us nature, both in its gritty and visceral textures and temperatures, as well as in its streaming nature of change. So it's often the first place that we can recognize papancha happening, mental proliferation, little ones and large ones. In a way, Luang Pu was sort of bursting the bubble of this probably pompous, you know, high-ranking meditation monk who wanted to talk about magical things and power and whatnot. Luang Pu says, "You know, I'm just not interested in that. Never have been. Doesn't mean anything to me. Have you ever heard of the heart that just smiles without any intention at all, by its own nature, because of the very purity of heart? The heart has no papancha in it. It only happens to the noble ones." But he'd say it kindly, you know, and with a heart of metta, you know, not really with any way intending to put the person down. This is nature. So, I think we left off the other evening with piti, and it started with mindfulness itself, and then mindfulness as it draws in Dhamma Vichaya, like wisdom in action, the non-conceptual investigation that notices, in essence, the two streams of reality, physicality stream and mentality stream. They're intertwined and inseparable, but they're noticed in every moment of awareness. Sometimes the discerning mind feels more the physicality, the textures of the body, or in visual experience, both the eye and light particles are also physical phenomena called rupa. And then in that contact moment, the seeing is a mental, it's a nama, it's a mental experience, seeing consciousness. And likewise, sound is rupa. It's textures. It's like the body, the material, the universe, and the contact with the inner sensitivity of the ear, also a physical phenomena. Rupa is the cause for hearing consciousness to arise. If there's not clear comprehension of that, and clear comprehension, remember, is part of sati sampajanya, mindfulness. And clear comprehension of purpose and suitability in the nature of phenomena. Or another word I use for that is just simply self-awareness in all that we do. If there isn't clear comprehension on how our experience is appearing moment to moment at the sense doors, then there's going to be papancha. Then we weave a story, you know, my eye and that object. There isn't a clue about the amazing nature of seeing and seeing consciousness and what seeing actually is. You know, it's not theory. It's not broken up into some idea that reality might be this way. It really is this way. Light hits the sensitivity of the eye, and sound the sensitivity of the ear, and flavor and taste, nose and tongue, and so forth. And then the receptor of the body that receives these phenomena, in that contact, experience happens. It's real, it's true, it's felt, it can be known, not imagined. It's not conceptual. The proliferation is then conceptual. So the investigation is discerning that. It's kind of slowly breaking up the habit of papancha. Every time we come back and just know, not my shoulder is painful, but we know heat and pressure somewhere in space, because often the idea of the body or parts of the body fall away, and it's just sensations somewhere in space. You know, the way a navigator, wayfinder, would have to sense through sound and scent and taste when the eye wasn't available at night, would have to sense the behavioral nature, lawful nature, to know where they were in this, you know, 25 million kilometer wilderness. So in the same way, we start to get to know things free of the papancha mind. And the movement of that creates this virya, this profound Dhamma energy, this strength and courage of heart that really then takes the task. I want to know what this is about. I want to know what this is that I call the body that gives me so much pleasure and gives me so much pain, and I have no control either one of them when they happen. And it, you know, if I'm sick, if I want to be healthy, it doesn't happen. And so on and so forth. So what's really going on so that I can understand without the stories, without the identification? So that brings forth this unique and balanced effort that knows how to bring up skillful states that haven't arisen and sustain them, and knows how to reduce unskillful states that have arisen and keep the ones that haven't arisen from arising. Those four qualities are clear definitions of Dhamma energy, you know, as well as the energy of a heroine or hero that just keeps going. And that leading to piti, which is what I ended with the other night, when genuine non-sensual joy arises from within the body and mind, it doesn't depend on what's happening in the sense fields. It doesn't depend on what we see and hear, smell, taste, touch, or think. It's generated by itself. In this same way, this, you know, Pali word, situpapatada, within itself, Dhamma within itself, the mind, heart that smiles, not through any intention or external force. So, piti is a Dhamma. It's a skillful Dhamma, very skillful Dhamma. It's known as a beautiful state. The Dhamma Bhavana. Bhavana is the word for meditation. Draws out these beautiful states. And piti is like the joy that feeds us from the marrow, from within outwardly, rather than trying to take outward in the way we do with pleasure. It's a difference between pleasure, attachment, and pleasure, and spiritual happiness, you know, Dhamma pleasure. So that arises, and it's felt on such a molecular level. So it begins to change everything. You know, and at first one can be intoxicated by it, of course, and attachment can form around it. But in the right set and setting, and you're protected, and you have really skillful guides, and you understand, well, this is piti. It's an awakening factor. It's bojanga, piti bojanga. It has a nature to lift the mind. You know, at first it's just a little thrilling. It's called, I think, a pileo erection. It means your hair stands up in the back of your head. and then if it moves along, you feel like you get hit with lightning. You get a jolt sometimes. I've seen you all go through that when I'm sneaking looks. Or if you're looking at me, sometimes you see a jerk, you know? That's like hit with lightning. It's just a sudden rush. And then it gets smoother and sweeter. Then it starts feeling like you're showering at a warm Japanese bath that has those waterfalls, and you're just bathing in it. We used to have long stops in Japan on our way to Burma, and use that 6 hours to take a train into Narita, and they'd have a men's and women's section in the bathhouse, and with all these, you know, water with tea and water that's really hot and water that's really cold, and you'd roll in salt and then walk through this thing and get showers, and you'd go outside to this bamboo grove and stand under this warm waterfall. And then a fourth kind of piti is uplifting. And sometimes that's when we're sitting or standing, you know, we're in our mindful posture and we know the posture that we're in, and it's the feeling that the whole body is being lifted up. It either begins to feel very light, or there's really this sensation that it's being elevated. You feel like you're being beamed up by Scotty, you know, or somebody up there. And that's uplifting joy. And then the most mature and the most necessary, most useful, in terms of a limb of awakening, of the piti bojanga, is what's called all suffusing or surging. It's like maybe you're lying on the beach in warm sun and warm sand, your body becomes the sand, warm waves come and just, you know, wash over you, and just feel filled, completely filled with this warm bath of embracing joy. You know, that's what it is, suffusing, all-suffusing, or surging joy. And it starts to level off. It's no longer the thrill of the previous, you know, more tender, younger kinds of joy. It starts to level off because it becomes the proximate cause for a deeper kind of spiritual happiness, an ease and well-being, a powerful body-mind comfort, even if there's still physical and mental disturbances, they're contained. So it's like your sense of being feels like a huge body of water, and the disturbances that come are just a few pebbles that are thrown in, immediately absorbed by it. Sukha, this deep ease. And that's the immediate cause for the bojanga of pasiti, calm. You know, in terms of the enlightenment factors, sukha is there. It's not named. It's just part. It's packed in there between the piti and the pasiti. And it's the immediate cause for calm to come. The fifth of the bojangas. Calm is also felt physically and emotionally, mentally and bodily, calm, a peace. It's a kind of peace that the PT doesn't go away, it just recedes, and it becomes like, you know, coordinated with the already developed previous bojangas, energy, investigation, you know, they're sort of set in motion now. And this process starts happening rather quickly and in cycles, as I mentioned, or as a chord, you know, a chord of movement of this, of these awakening factors. So pusati is what happens when the mind feels secluded, and seclusion is usually from the hindrances, the hindrances of wanting and a dissatisfaction, sloth and lethargy, restlessness and anxiety, doubt. Those are abated by the power of pusati. You know, so at peace and so at ease feels the body. We feel like we can hold anything, not afraid of anything. It's like a fearless calm in this pusati, this ease. And you know, that would be the thing I'd always notice about these monks. So this monk I was talking about, Luangpu, was 95 when I met him. And another one I had met in Burma 10 years later, or maybe 20 years later, actually. It's 103. And I met him a year before he died. And as soon as we entered the grounds of his monastery, I felt the peace. Just the way things grew there, including the buildings, that everything. The car seemed to turn off by itself, and everything was silent. And I went with Saira Ulakana, you know, who we teach with there, in his monastery, 15 kilometers south on the river. You know, so we went north and then inward in the Sagain Hills to find this person that I'm pretty sure wouldn't be around much longer, which was true. And walked into his cottage, was almost this size. And I was probably in there 15 minutes or more before I even knew that he was completely blind and nearly deaf. And I only knew that because his attendant, when he asked the attendant to introduce each of us who was there, I realized we, first of all, couldn't see us. And then because the attendant needed a megaphone, basically, to yell into his ear to say, you know, five times, Stephen Smith from Hawaii, so loud that, you know, it was kind of a little disturbing almost. But he wanted to know. He wanted to know the name, and he wanted to touch the person he was introduced to. So go up and the respectful bow to the robes, Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. And then he wanted to feel the hands. And these were the first time I was ever aware of touching hands of peace. And I could probably only describe them this way. In temperature, they were a cool warmth. In texture, they were as smooth as silk, and at the same time firmly held my one hand with his two. And then I put my second hand there. It just seemed appropriate. And what transpired, I can't say even how long that was so. And after there was an introduction to my friends and I, when we sat there for some timeless hours, when we were about to leave, he called each one of us by memory, and to greet us and bless and give us a blessing. And his blessing was simple and a powerful teaching transmission. He said to, he would take the hands again, those hands of peace, and he'd say, may you be happy, may you be peaceful, may you be free of even a single unskillful mind moment. You know, exactly what Luang Pu was talking about, the heart that smiles of its own accord, of its own nature, unprompted, with no intention. It's that purity, that wish that these limbs of awakening take us beyond this fabrication, proliferation called papancha, to that place where we are genuinely free, happy and peaceful and free of even one unskillful mind moment. You know, it wasn't anything other than a pure blessing and teaching. It wasn't like a lecture, and it wasn't a social nicety. It's like I was hit with the light of that. It filled my heart. And now that would have been before the first time I was banned, because when I came back to Burma and was again blacklisted, he was already passed away. So, you know, it was maybe in 97 or 98, but I remember it like it was a moment ago. I remember the feeling of those hands and the peace from them. That's how I could relate pustody to someone who embodied it, who had it as a perfection. So that part of our limb of awakening is what continues to keep the mind in seclusion from disturbances, from, you know, like the bamboo mind I talk about. If our minds were too rigid about things, it becomes brittle, you know, and brittle breaks. But bamboo just bends. Its strength is in its vulnerability, its hollowness. So, yeah, in the world, when we go back out, we'll be tempted and we'll be intimidated every day in little ways. But this pustody that we've been receiving as a transmission here, because they're all inside of us. It's not something we're getting outside of ourselves. They all have the same quality of situ papada, which means they live inherently within. We can still call them up in daily life. Here they become naturally charged. You don't have to do anything. And hearing about them, of course, can help when we're in deep meditation like this. But they're doing the Dhamma intelligence knows how to develop itself. The intelligence of the heart is already doing that. But it doesn't hurt now to have some understanding of them and realize that in daily life, peace is really important. And whatever ways we can create seclusion in our lives, a walk, a solitary walk, a meal in mindfulness, quiet time with a friend, some study, some writing and contemplation, but with the idea not of escape and not of the habit of going off into a papancha state, fabrication, embellishment, where we lose the plot, but of genuine seclusion, like Luang Pu, where his rest was profound and awake at the same time, clear, and feel that the mind, heart, and body are just protected from these distractions of the mind wanting more, you know, and of buying into our ill will about things, our critical mind to ourselves, to the world. We're on guard at that. We can call in this power of peace that we have within us and that we're developing here, the gift of Dhamma that we're receiving from our practice, and overcoming the kind of lethargy, not, you know, being genuinely tired, but when we use lethargy and sloth as a defense against feelings. And particularly peace is quite the opposite, isn't it, of restlessness and anxiety. And it's the direct remedy when the body, mind feel that frenetic dis-ease, anxiousness. Peace just chills it out. Peace is a cool mind. Quite the opposite of disturbance. Because of this capacity of body, mind, peacefulness, and seclusion, the samadhi can come in. Samadhi means unification of mind or collectedness of mind, one-pointedness of heart, meaning it's not fragmented, it's not fractured, it's not scattered. It's gathered together like many streams in the back of a valley with the thick raindrops that fill up and slowly collect in one large pond. That large pond, stilled by the pasiddhi, now becomes firm in its collectedness. So sometimes people report feeling they're sitting there and they feel the whole mind and body feel somehow as solid as a rock and yet yielding. It doesn't feel hard, it just feels solid, it feels compact. That's a very strong, you know, visceral experience of samadhi. There's nothing that's, tearing off into one fabrication or another. Unification is intact. And whether we apply it to the heart of immeasurable love to ourselves or all beings, which is one direction we can take it, or whether we're using it in this thread or cord of the limbs of awakening, that would be our wise reflection, our choice at the time. Because each of these limbs have their own nature. They can work in and of themselves, or as the Buddha discovered, they work together as the way to self-realization. So we want to respect all those ways. Each individual quality is a powerful anchor and source of the heart, and then the way they work together, each one being the proximate cause of the next in succession, where the last one, again, like equanimity, is the cause for the most pure mindfulness, the most pure sati. And then how they work like seven strings of a instrument, a lute, that when they're in tune, you play the chord, and those are insights or awakening moments. It's how strong it is. So samadhi, we've had quite a bit of experience with, just by nature, and we can feel physical sensations of it. We can see how that collected nature occurs mentally and emotionally when thoughts seem to work together, seem to gather together as a powerful mental formations. Think of a turbulent system with, a wild storm like this, and we look out at the sea, and there's just dozens and dozens and hundreds of waves, separate waves. And then think of a sea in deep ocean navigation with just ground swells. It's big, powerful, unified movements of water that aren't like myriad little separate disturbing waves. It's just the sea is still, with that pasiddhi-like stillness. And the whole ocean has this collectedness of samadhi. And it's not without movement, but the movement aren't all these fractured little wave components. It's just massive movement of a groundswell that will come and go, lift the boat up and set the boat down. And the water's still really clear. You can look in the water and see down as much as 30 or more meters, and often it reflects the sky quite perfectly and clearly. So we're beginning to have, I think, a felt sense of this samadhi and its basis, its foundation for wisdom and equanimity. Without it, it's impossible. It's the proximate cause for wisdom and equanimity. This samadhi, bhojanga, the sixth of the seven factors of limbs of awakening. I'm going to get through this tonight. Right. A couple of the text images for samadhi. Like, and if you've ever been, a number of you I know, you know, are nature beings and have even been hiking in places like in the Southwest where it's hot and dry. So one image you use for samadhi is like you're walking in a hot, dry desert, and suddenly you come under the shade of a cool tree, and there's a big jar of pure drinking water. The feeling of that, the body, mind, emotion, feeling of that. and it's everything we want. We're in that shade, we drink that water, and we want nothing else. You know, so if we were going to say exactly which limb of awakening repels desire, well, this is it. The samadhi, the mind that's so collected and content upon itself, it needs nothing more. It's lacking for nothing. It feels no poverty. That shade, that water. And it's also what is the force behind the most powerful metta we generate for ourselves, that we reside in, the samadhi, metta, citta, the concentrated heart of metta. We can do anything we want with it. We can fill every molecule of our body. We can fill the space around us, and, you know, every person, any sense of difference, our history, any papancha around anyone just isn't there. And that's the very mature kind of metta, what we were teaching in the last retreat, the first retreat. This is the Brahma-Vihara metta. So, upekkha. Now we have our foundation, you know, if we look at it in terms of each one being the proximate cause, and each one, in a way, also maturing in the other one, like investigation becoming virya in the way that virya is the energetic presence of the mind of inquiry, awareness of inquiry, and that becoming the interest that grows into a rapturous, you know, awe in this phenomena we call body-mind, nama-rupa, that each one is grown into the next, so that it's still all there. And then sort of rolls into the stillness. And ease of the pasiti, the peacefulness, and the collectedness of the samadhi. Each one a little bit different. And here, just use a little bit of wise reflection. See if you can just even feel it now in the body, and feel it in the mind. All of them, all these six, are now the foundation for this this upekkha that has, it grows out of the deepest part of our wisdom, the most innate punya or vipassana. It's the most subtle of them all. And it's because of the upekkha that the other ones get stronger. And this upekkha, as we know, has a similar use in the Brahma-vihara, in the practices with metta, compassion, empathetic joy. And it also has its use in the paramis, and you'll see it everywhere. And it can be considered, in this case, the same as the eye of wisdom, because it is seen so through fabrication. It is seen right through that papancha, that what allures the mind or impedes the mind or intimidates the mind just has no effect. There's just this incredible sense of being in the midst of things as they are. It's called the vicissitudes, facing the sankharas, all formations, all mental and physical formations do not disturb the upekkha heart, the heart of upekkha. It's also unbothered in our daily life, and this is a more practical application and understanding, by what we face every day, pleasure and pain, praise and blame, good repute, good reputation, ill repute, and gain and loss. In so many ways, in our work, in our art, in our relations, in our regards to ourselves, in our projects planned for that day, all of these things apply every single day. And they have nothing to do with whether we're doing something right or wrong. These eight worldly conditions, loka dhamma, dhamma here means, it's the small d, Cynthia, just means phenomena, nature, and loka, world, worldly nature, or way of the world. We're presented all the time. It's just karmic results from, or you could say, genetic, you know, results from things in the past. We're always going to meet pleasure, praise, and a good reputation, and gain, whether we deserve it or not. Whether we deserve it or not, you know, people win the lottery or, you know, really have a very happy experience at the result of someone else having an unhappy experience. And really noble people, including the Buddha and Luang Pu, and, you know, have days where they're blamed, you know, or assaulted by jealous monks, or bodily pain about something. Whether we deserve it or not, it's just the way of the world. And I find it kind of a handy mantra at times. Whatever I'm facing, I just say way of the world. Or I say loka dhamma. So I don't get attached to the gain and the praise and the pleasure and so forth. And I don't drop into despair. You know, where I can pull myself out of despair when I just loka dhamma, at blame and pain and loss. So equanimity is the centerboard or the navigation rudder in our travels through turbulent systems and moving through turbulent systems, learning how to go, which way to go. Understanding that worldly conditions happen as natural phenomena, and there's no control of it. It happens whether we want it to or don't want it to. The only thing we can do is deepen our understanding. Phenomena presents itself to us every moment through all the sense doors. So the eight worldly conditions work in every sense field. You know, sights and sounds and senses and sensations and mental phenomena, emotive formations, all carry that same weightiness. They arrive at our door uninvited, as well as, you know, the guy, what's his name, you know, Bill McMahon with the $1 million lottery check or something. Here, you won today, you know. All these things happen, pleasant and unpleasant, uninvited. And our wisdom is in understanding that, is the wide and serene mind of acceptance. That's upekkha. That's being in the midst of things as they are. So, I'll close with an example of a mentor embodying these qualities, especially the upekkha. In the mid-70s, I was sitting in a Japanese temple in India during the hot season by invitation. It was the only cool place to sit because you could go down underneath the temple, open up this old wooden, medieval-looking, dungeon-like trap door, and go down underneath into the dungeon, which saw we stayed this, maintained this very cool temperature. He had a lot of the Buddhist texts there. He was a Japanese Zen master, so rolled up were a lot of teachings, and they were protected there from too much weather change. And his name was Shibuya-san. His first and foremost love was Dhamma and sharing Dhamma. But he was also responsible for this complex as a pilgrimage, particularly for Japanese tourists. He didn't like that part, but he had to do it. And he was always engaged in dispute with the authorities in Tokyo. So what he would do is oversee things during the day. There was a school, the pilgrimage house, a beautiful Zen garden, and people operating everything, teaching, you know, raking the sands and cutting the reeds and cleaning the pools in the garden, doing administrative things. And the few people who were allowed to stay there and practice, we had our jobs. And then he'd finish at 10 o'clock at night. He'd sleep for 4 hours. And because of his deep love of Dhamma and wanting to put the papancha behind him, we'd meet at the trap door at 2 a.m. and go down under the dungeon. And we practice together, Shibuya-san and this young, you know, wide-eyed student, myself, one sitting, 4 hours. And at 6 o'clock, he'd ring a little bell, and we'd go up, and the visitors, you know, Western spiritual seekers from Europe and America and Australia, whatever, they'd have arrived from Bodh Gaya, guest houses and other residences, and we'd have a sitting and a walking and a reading for an hour and a half, and then go to the corner and bow to the Bodhi tree, the corner of the Japanese temple, one corner. So this went on for 3 months. I could always tell when he had a bad day with Tokyo. So the story ends now on one of his particularly worst day, and he actually had come back from Patna, a long trip away, and had to meet with officials who were scolding him for not taking good enough care of the pilgrims, who were really only interested in partying. When the pilgrims were there, the place was smoke-filled and you know, just parties and photographing spiritual phenomena, whatever that is, you know. So he was really tired this night, but he was still there at 2 a.m. We went down and we sat together, and I could feel the energy in him. Didn't understand, but just I could feel something was different. And what I always noticed about him, because I cheated a lot, you know. I opened my eyes and we'd watch him because he'd sit like the Buddha, and it just without moving. And I couldn't even tell if he was breathing. We just had a little candlelight. I never saw him look at the clock. Just when it was right 6 o'clock, he'd ring the bell. I don't know how he knew it was 6 o'clock. So this night I'm peeking, and every few minutes, his body's moving like the hour hand of a clock. He's bending over out of weariness, like we feel like doing or actually do sometimes when there's no teacher here, you know, that our bodies lie down. And so he was going over for 4 hours. And just before six, I heard his first sounds. He made a couple of snores, you know, like... And that woke him up. He rang the bell. It was six. We went up. There were 12 or 15, meditators, Western meditators. We did our chanting and our sitting and a little short little mindful circle walk, and then went to the corner facing the Bodhi tree of the temple, the Japanese temple. And I'm up to this point, I'm pretty okay with things. It's always a nice, refreshing hit to come out of that dungeon. And this morning, particularly, because the sun was just starting to rise, the full moon was setting. And it was still pretty dark out in the Japanese garden. And I couldn't see. I was right behind Shibuya-san. And he bowed, and so the rest of us bowing to the Bodhi tree. And then halfway through the bow, this thunderous, ferocious roar. It shook everything. Shook the building, it shook the heavens, it shook the Bodhi tree. It shook every molecule in my body. It took me a good few seconds to realize it was Shibuya-san himself roaring. And then seeing these cameras flying all over the place, you know, and flashbulbs breaking on rocks and people falling into the ponds. And in seconds, there's about a half dozen pilgrims who were ready to capture this spiritual event. They were gone. They were absolutely gone. But I was contracted and congealed in total terror. And the usual ritual after bowing is he'd turn and bow to each of us, Ohayo gozaimasu, Ohayo gozaimasu, Japanese for good morning, Ohayo gozaimasu. And so he turned that day. That's right, there was a visiting Japanese monk in front of me. He bowed first to the Japanese monk, and then he came and bowed to me. And the ritual was we'd make eye contact halfway through, as we were finishing the bow, coming back up. And I couldn't make it. I was too terrified. I was just frozen. And so, but he wouldn't move. And until I looked, he wouldn't move. So I looked. And what I saw was just these smiling eyes. And this light coming in one eye from the rising sun, and this silvery other light in the other eye from the setting moon, and just this gorgeous, exquisite peace of equanimity, you know, following the fierce and thunderous, compassionate roar, this exquisite peace, and all the way down, Ohayo gozaimasu, Ohayo gozaimasu. Really cool, chilled out being with beyond fabrication. It was a smile from within that didn't need any external phenomena. Let's sit with that for a moment. Sittu Pappada, Sittu Pappada. movement of the mind that smiles within, unprompted, arising out of purity, a moment of purity, understanding, equanimity.